Asheville FM on WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville. This is Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness.
And I'm William Goodenough.
This show can also be heard on KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KXCF in Marshall, California, KOWA LP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS in Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be heard a week after broadcast on the finalstrawradio.noblogs.org. And you can reach us for comments at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. If you care to write us a letter, please address it to The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806.
In this first segment of the episode, William, that's me, spoke with Ann Peterman of the Global Justice Ecology Project, following up on the GE Trees Action Camp, which took place in late September outside of Asheville. To hear the previous interview, you can go to thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org and search GE Trees. And to learn more about GJEP and to donate to Ann and Ruddy's legal defense, you can go to nogetrees.org.
For the bulk of the hour, we'll hear the second half of the former prisoner panel preceding the North American Anarchist Black Cross Conference in Denver of 2015.
Would you introduce yourself and talk a little bit about what you do?
Sure. My name is Ann Peterman. I'm the executive director of Global Justice Ecology Project, and I'm also the international coordinator of the Campaign to Stop Genetically Engineered Trees. 1999 to stop the menace of genetically engineered trees from reaching commercial levels in the wild, in the environment. And so, been working on this for a long time.
Gotcha. But for those listeners who didn't catch our last interview, would you mind talking briefly about GJEP?
Sure. Global Justice Ecology Project was founded in 2003 by myself and my partner, Oren. And it was founded with the idea of looking at the root causes of environmental destruction, social injustice, and economic domination. So really looking at the intertwined roots of these different issues and how we can address those successfully. And we use the issue of genetically engineered trees to do that because it intersects all of those different areas, from climate change to, you know, indigenous people's lands to forests and so on. We're a nonprofit organization, so we're based in Buffalo, New York, but we have Ruddy, who works with us in Florida. And then we have members all over the world, actually, so members and supporters. So, we have done a lot of international work in the past. At this point, we're more focusing on the United States.
Would you tell us about the action camp that took place just outside of Asheville about a month ago? How many attendees were present, and what was your take on how the event went?
We did this Southeast GE Trees Action Training Camp starting on the 24th of September, and it was really great, actually. We had about 25 participants over the 4 days that the Action Camp took place, and, you know, covered all kinds of different aspects of what you would need, the skills you would need to take on genetically engineered trees from a direct action activist perspective, you know, from Know Your Rights to a GE Trees 101 session. And people seemed to be really excited about it. We had a lot of interactive workshops, not just, you know, talking heads, but people really getting in there and getting their hands dirty. And I think people enjoyed it and got a lot out of it. And, you know, it really inspired some new connections for us with people from that region that I think will be important moving forward as we continue to build the campaign.
Is there anything that you would have liked to see be done differently?
We would have liked to have had even more people. We had about 25, which was great. We would love to have had 50 or 75, but, you know, these things are not that easy to get people to come out for a full 4 days. We will likely do another one in the future and try to do it at a time of year that's more, easier for people to participate for the longer period of time.
So would you talk about the action which took place on September 28th? How did it go, and are there still people needing financial support?
Sure. So we ended the 4-day GE Trees Action Training Camp with a GE Trees Action, which seemed to make sense, which we did at the world headquarters of ArborGen. And ArborGen is one of the leading developers, researchers and developers of genetically engineered trees in the world. Their world headquarters are in Ridgeville, South Carolina, kind of close to Charleston, which has been underwater pretty much since our action. But they also have, ArborGen also has offices and facilities in Brazil, in Australia, New Zealand, and other places. So they're a global company, but we felt it was very important to target their world headquarters to expose what they're doing and also to what we were trying to do with the action was bring to them symbolic petitions representing all of the people who in 2015 alone have spoken out against genetically engineered trees, either signed a petition or sent a letter in or whatever. And globally, more than 269,000 people just this year have signed on to reject genetically engineered trees. So we wanted to let ArborGen know that their GE trees research is absolutely rejected by the public. And we also wanted them to stop being so secretive about their GE trees research. They won't tell people what they're doing up until this action anyway. And as a result of the action, they actually made their first public statement about their GE loblolly pine trees, which was really important because up until then, we knew that they had been given permission from the government to pursue these GE trees commercially, but they would not tell anyone, not even reporters, what they were doing with these GE trees. So after our action, they finally made a public statement saying they're not pursuing these GE trees right now. So that's, good news, assuming they're not lying to us. But, up until this action, they wouldn't say it. So this action was really important to get them to make that statement.
That's some extremely direct results. I don't often hear about that.
So the action, as I said, we were trying to deliver these symbolic petitions representing these, 269,000 people who've rejected GE trees. We didn't even get as far as the ArborGen property. So the ArborGen property is part of this larger business park that's actually on land owned by MeadWestvaco. MeadWestvaco is one of the joint owners of ArborGen. And ArborGen itself, their facility is surrounded by an 8-foot chain link fence topped with barbed wire. They're very, very secretive and paranoid in there. So we didn't even get to the gates of ArborGen when we were arrested for a trespass. So it was myself and Ruddy, our GE Trees campaigner, who were arrested for trespass. And now we're in the aftermath of this, working with attorneys in South Carolina to figure out how we deal with the charges that we have. And you asked, do we still need donations to deal with this? And absolutely, yes. We're just at the beginning stages of having to address our charges. We're going to have to go back to South Carolina at least once, possibly twice. All of these things cost money. And of course, all of the different legal expenses. We will be having a pro bono attorney, I believe, but there are still expenses that are associated with going to trial and so on. So if people want to make donations, they can go to the No GE Trees page, nogetrees.org page, and they'll see a donate button. You can click that. And if you want to make sure it just goes toward our legal expenses, there's a box at the bottom where you can make comments and you can just put for the legal fund in there and your donations will be directed specifically toward that. That's a really good thing to do as well.
What would your recommendations for folks who are interested in either attending or organizing an action camp like this one be?
I would recommend people go to our website, nogetrees.org. You can go to that, which takes you specifically to the GE Trees related page on the Global Justice Ecology Project website. And somewhere in there, there's a button where you can contact us. And if people are interested in taking part in a future action camp, they can just let us know right now, I'm interested, please keep me informed. And or people can get on our mailing list where we will, our GE Trees mailing list, where we will give people information about future activities like this training camp. If people want to take on their own training camp and organize one themselves, get a hold of us and we'll see what we can do to send people down there as trainers. We're absolutely open to figuring out how to work with folks, especially in the Southeast, which is really ground zero for GE trees in the U.S.
Is there anything else that you'd like to mention that we didn't get into?
This is an ongoing issue. ArborGen may be saying that they're not doing GE loblolly pine right now in the Southeast, but they do still have a petition pending for GE eucalyptus trees that the USDA is creating an environmental impact statement for. So that's very serious. In the Pacific Northwest, there's all kinds of GE poplar research going on. So this is very much an ongoing issue. And so, the more people get involved, the more people sign our petitions against GE trees or get plugged in to take action in whatever way people are comfortable with, the better off we are. And so I encourage people to get a hold of us and get plugged in.
Thank you again for coming onto the show.
Thank you very much.
And now time travels to September in Denver of this year. Firstly, you'll hear from Jerry Coach, an anarchist who was incarcerated over 9 months for refusing to testify before a grand jury for a second time in New York, as he talks about his incarceration and his release. Following this, a question and answer period in which you'll hear responses from Jerry Coach, Eric McDavid, Kazi Torre, Lynn Stewart, Mark Cook, and Jihad Abdul-Mamit. Eric McDavid is a green anarchist who served 10 years of a 20-year sentence before release in January of 2015. Lynn Stewart is a movement lawyer who served 2.5 years of a 10-year sentence, released due on compassionate grounds due to terminal cancer. Kazi Torre is a formerly incarcerated member of the Marxist guerrilla group United Freedom Fighters / the Ohio 7. Jihad Abdul-Mamit is a national chairperson for the Jericho Movement and spent 23 years in prison for involvement in the Black Panther Party and the Black Liberation Army. Mark Cook was a social prisoner who founded a Panther chapter in prison and became involved in the George Jackson Brigade.
All right. I guess that makes it my turn. My name's Jerry Coach, and I don't know what the hell I'm doing here because I'm at a table with people like this who fought and suffered and really meant what they said and continue to mean what they said. And it's a real privilege. I don't say that to seem disingenuous or to seem flowery or overly emotional, but I mean it. I used to, when I was incarcerated, read about these people and their struggles, as some of them have gotten out at that point, some of them are still there. And it's really amazing to be able to share a table one time. I'm just going to say a few things about my case, which was a little weird, and a few general statements about prison, which I think is probably agree is a terrible thing to choose. But I was incarcerated for refusing to cooperate with the grand jury. Which means I was held in civil detention. I was never charged with a crime, nor was I suspected of one. But I was held in civil contempt because I was called before a grand jury, federal subpoena, and I refused to get names. I can go into the ins and outs of the process, but basically they drag you out and they say, tell us everything, and you say, f*** yourself, and they incarcerate you. Until you cooperate. You can get out in a day, the second you choose to cooperate. So they make it as bad as they can, moving you around and messing with your mail and solitary and threats and blah, blah, blah. But you know what? While I was in, I never thought about cooperating. And I'll tell you why. It wasn't because there's something special about me or what I did. Because I mean what I say, and my friends mean what they say, and the people that I met in prison, they meant what they said, and they continue to do so. Okay? Some of the most amazing people I've met in my life are trapped in cages, and will be for many years, and potentially for the rest of their lives. And they don't deserve that. They meant what they said, and they did not. So many of them, the ones that I met and came close with and respect, they chose not to cooperate as well. And that's just considered standard, all right, for so many people, especially for oppressed and marginalized people of color. And when I do it for political reason without being charged for the crime, right, now it's a big deal. But these people, it's, for so many of them, it's day-to-day refusing to bow to authority, right? It's day-to-day refusing to give names, and it's day-to-day meaning what they say. And you pay a price for that, right? You pay a price for standing up to bullies. And I hate bullies. It's probably something that all of us at this table share. Anyway, I was eventually released after my my lawyer and best friend, who visited me like clockwork when I was going through some personal stuff and having a real rough time. It wasn't any visits and crying, blah, 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 blah. She would just come talk to me about my, I owe a lot of my sanity to her. She got me out because she submitted what's called a girl's motion, right? And that makes the argument that I will obviously never cooperate. And therefore, what should be coercive detention, which is totally illegal for some reason, has now become punitive. And punitive detention is only legal if you are charged with and convicted of a crime. I'm sure you could explain this much better than I, by the way, but yeah, I'll give it a shot. So anyway, I left prison after a relatively short amount of time. It was painful and difficult for a number of ways, especially because I had no idea when or if I would leave. Yes, grand juries do expire, but they can extend them. They can re-impanel them, right? It's a weird, I hate using this word because it's so overused now, but it's a very Kafkaesque process. And it's also an incredibly draconian and oppressive element within the American legal system, which is really saying something because that's really a way to describe the whole damn thing. But I left because she made this argument that I would never cooperate. And so they kicked me out with no notice in the middle of the blizzard in my sweats at the end of January last year. And I had no f***ing idea what to do. I thought it was a joke. And so I asked, what's going on? What's happening? Do I get a phone call? And you could ask you someone's cell phone, I guess. They really just kicked me out. So I just stood outside of prison for as long as I could, waiting at my old unit, sit in the hope that they could see me and know that I got out and that they will get out. And I firmly believe that they will get out. And that's what I fight for, and that's why I'm sitting at this table, and that's why So I left prison, but prison didn't leave me. But I left some of the best men I've met in my life behind. And so help me God, which I do not believe in for the record, I will see these men out and back with us in the land of the living. That's my plan. That's my promise, for that matter. But if you can do anything, and other people have said this so much more eloquently than me, write to someone in prison, write to someone who's in for political reasons, who's a political prisoner, a prisoner of war, or write to someone who's in for non-political reasons, whatever, just write to someone in prison. That letter means so much. During my worst times, getting those letters when I was in solitary and such is really what kept me. So, thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
And may we work together to earn every single prison to the ground.
So, this person over here had asked for Jerry and for Eric, folks who have gotten out most recently, how are you doing in general?
You want to take it or shall I?
You still want it.
Not very well. prison is, to put it lightly, is a living hell. And it has very strong effects. I got out and I was very sad, very isolated, pushed people who were close to me away, and very self-destructive. While I put all those things in the past tense, many of them applying in the present tense as well. I'm lucky that I have a community that supports me. I have family close to my mother, and I have close friends who were there to pick me up when I fell down and help me get up again and again and again. So that's all I'm doing.
Here's Eric McDavid's response to the question.
How am I doing? I think I'm doing all right. I mean, I've been able to relate to it. Basically, that I'm just still in prison, except for physically I'm out. Like, being on supervised release, you still have to run routines, and you still have to relate to your environment as if you're in prison, because you got to deal with a cop. It's like we're dealing with, like, the worst CO that you've ever dealt with. And on top of that, you got to go deal with your PO, because you just dealt with a CO. Probation officer, correctional officer. So, like, I'm going to school right now full time, so they have this line that you have to walk on, and so you just walk that and maintain basically how it was in prison. Just maintain it that way. Like, this is awesome. This is not what happened in prison. So very, very appreciated for everyone for that this experience. So it's like, in different ways, it did happen. Yeah, in much smaller circles. But there's definitely the aspects of still being in. And I mean, it's just where it's at right now. I mean, that will shift once the press release changes. But, like, I got a huge support, and that's more than anything right now. That's continued on ever since I got out. Like, every day. And I can feel it. I can feel it on the inside. That hasn't shifted one smidge. I can feel that every day when I wake up, right before I go to sleep. The support's there. And that's what really matters. And that's what helps maintain it.
I have a question for everybody on the panel. So when you're in there and you're not dealing with your terms, I got to imagine, and only imagine, that life gets very compressive, and that's got a weigh on your actual mind if you want to get a soul. How would you safeguard that when you're in such an environment where you can't necessarily trust everybody next to you? You shouldn't. How do you keep yourself going, learning? Where do you find your safety? Was there a technique? Was it breathing? I just got to imagine, after years or even a short amount of time, it's got to be debilitating. There has to be a way that you are all here standing in front of us sharing your information. Did you have any techniques to keep yourself safe on the inside when you were there?
This is Kazi Torre of the UFF's response.
I want to answer real quick. First, I want to say thank that person who asked about these two people who just recently got out, because that's really important. You know, like, I remember the first year that I got out, it was like I almost went back. I don't know how many times, you know, like, because all your support that you had for the last 10 years or whatever is inside. I mean, when I first hit Leavenworth, if it wasn't for Jihad coming to my cell, I mean, he came to my cell, I'm in an 8-man cell with everybody that has, 200 years. They sent me to Leavenworth for 6 years, trying to get me took out, you know what I mean? Like, I had 6 years when I hit there. That's all. Like, everybody there had like 200 years or more, you know? It's like, and then people looking at you. So it was really good to ask that question about these guys, because coming back out, reacclimation is really that. I know that first year was pretty tough, you know? And inside, I think isolation, you just go to a different place, you know, like, and you're doing your time different. There was comrades in most joints, but a couple of spots, there wasn't any comrades, and that's just a little dicey, but most places, you got a few comrades a few people, you know, one person, anyways, that you can connect with and watch your back. But that to me was Jihad, Mark, you know, Leavenworth, it was Oscar. There's a lot of different people. And we had the African Culture Society there. So,
let's hear from Mark Cook.
I recovered. When I first got out, I had, like I say, a lot of support. And when I say the anarchists, they raised $8,000 for me. When I hit the streets, they gave me $8,000. You don't get that kind of money. You generally get from prison about maybe $100, some only $40, but that's what you survive on, maybe $100 and a bus ticket. and you got to go from there. You got to find a job where it says, you're an ex-offender, you can't have a job. You try and get a place to stay, and they say, if you're an ex-offender, you can't stay in this place because you're an ex-offender. And it goes on and on like that. Okay, but that monetary support I got, that was cool. I really, really appreciated it. I can't think of another prisoner who got that much and who was going to live. I happened to Marilyn Buck $15,000, me and my co-defendant. No, excuse me, not $15,000. It was $2,000. It was the rest of the Bay Area gave, brought it up to $15,000. And she died within, 2 weeks?
2 weeks.
2 weeks after we gave her the money. It's rarely that there's that much support for a prisoner who's somebody who's getting out of prison. And it should be that way all the time. Everybody's got money. You can spend, $12 for a pack of cigarettes? You can't give $12 to somebody coming out of prison. If everybody here, who smokes, that is, who gave a prisoner $12, that's a good start for a prisoner, whether he's a social prisoner or a political prisoner or a prisoner of war. I have nightmares. I still have nightmares trying to get out of prison. And my comrade, Ed Mead, he has them too. He says his are diminishing. Mine are changing. They're weird things. And talking about maintaining our sanity, I don't know if I maintain my sanity. If I'm still having them nightmares, I don't know. Memory is supposed to be a loss of memory is supposed to be due to old age and stuff like that. But me and Lynn are still not talking about that. He thinks something else, probably medication for taking his tongue and all that stuff. But that's about all I have to say about how I feel when I got out of prison.
Here's Lynn Stewart taking a stab at the question.
Well, I got through prison by reading tremendous amounts, yep, book upon book upon book. I got through prison because every night at 8 o'clock I would call Ralph and he would bring me up to date on what was happening with the defense committees, what he was doing, what they were doing, who was, I should just say, and the gossip as well. And I got through prison, my family, my children, I was very fortunate. None of them deserted me. And I can tell you one of the things that makes me a little queasy when I think of these prison, black is the new orange or orange is the new black. They don't show the terrible heartache. I, along with Eric, was so fortunate because I got so many letters that the prison actually moved me from a very, very uncomfortable place where I had been put, where I had to walk 6 flights of stairs 3 times a day just to eat. And I was sick in those days as well. Anyway, and I got at one Christmas time, it was right after I went in, I must have gotten 200 letters one day. And the next day they moved me to the medical wing, where I could be in among where it was easier to live. Let's just put it that way. They do pay attention. So it's not only when you're writing, you don't only write to the prisoner. It's very good for him, but or her. But it's also, it shows the prison there are people on the outside that are monitoring, that know that someone's in there that they care about. And that is extremely important. And those letters also kept me alive, and answering them and thinking about them. And many people have come to me in the past now, not so far past, and say, I still have the letter you wrote to me from prison. I have it on my refrigerator. I have it on my bulletin board. Because I look at it every day and I say, if she could do this, I can do it too. So you play a very difficult, it's a role that none of us are completely used to. And we're certainly not used to the terrible, terrible arbitrary authority which we are faced in prison. That is, that any guard on any day can change the rules and do what he wants to you. I'm not talking physics, I'm talking about lock you up, bring charges against you, put you in the shoe, just make your life miserable. And that is why, as I say, we are doing this initiative to get people at least some legal protection. But more importantly, I want to say that when I got out, I was very lucky. I was greeted at the airport by hundreds of people. And that was, and with tons of flowers, and all my grandchildren were there. And that welcoming back to the community was really so very important to me. And I have to say, I'm happy to say that at a subsequent Valentine's Day welcoming me home, we raised probably around $20,000 for us to get started again and to be again, because I couldn't work any longer. They've taken that away from me. They've taken away from me the ability to communicate with my sisters who are still sitting at Carswell, some of them dying at Carswell, because I'm not allowed to communicate with a person who is still in jail. Anyway, to make a long story short, you do suffer, you do go through some stuff. It's not the same, you're not the same personality altogether, but you get past it and you know it changed you in some very positive ways as well. And that's why I think all of us are here tonight, because that positive way we're trying to communicate to you. Thank you.
Now we'll hear the voice of Jihad Abdul-Mumit.
Well, I diddle what all of my comrades have already said a little bit. You know, 23 years is a little bit of time there, so I think in time itself is relative. It's a relative thing. You know, somebody can get popped and be in the county jail for a week or two and be so stressed. And the stress will be real because it's relative what's going on in their life and how it's impacting them. And then you can run across somebody that's been down 20 years. They say, man, after all, I'll go home in 2 years, man. And you're like, what? And they'll be happy as a lark. But so for me, I think it was a combination, as Lynn said, when I got finally incarcerated, it was January 23rd, 1976, so there was some remnants of movement, if you will, still going on, and there was a lot of esprit de corps. You know, Asada was liberated in November 2nd, 1979, so we still had actions going on in the street. So the war was still being fought, and you were just a captive, and the war continued inside. So we had, like Kazi said, there were other comrades inside. Muslims, the Muslim community embraced me. A lot of comradeliness in there. And it may seem like irony, which it is, but we had, and those were boding places, there were many good times. You know, as Lynn kind of alluded to, this, you know, be laughing, it was weird, but you know, the human mind can adjust and do some phenomenal things. And maybe some of you have already been incarcerated. In the worst of situations, even on the street, you know, your mind is good. And there were some hard days too, lockdowns. I went to Lewisburg when I first got there. I think I was about 22, still the age limit. It might have been 26, people whistling at my ass and all that. And a little bit unsettling, to say the least. And, you know, being put in a situation, you know, they took me to 9mm. What am I supposed
to do? Go for it. And I must have weighed about 140 pounds. So I get there, I'm too young. And when I leave, I'm too old. Now, you know, at some point in time, the floodgate of youngsters come in. Now, I mean, when I get there, I'm young, looking at a bunch of older guys. When I leave, I'm older guy, looking at a bunch of younger guys. I'm still scared. Not really, but, you know. So I think I was very fortunate in prison in the sense that I was always supported internally. I was speaking when we were at, comrades picked us up this morning, that actually, when we were captured, this notion of political prisoners in the United States, it really wasn't solidified amongst individuals like myself, 19 years old, Robin Banks, with the Black Liberation Army. We're just going for it. You get popped, you're just trying to get out of there, you're trying to escape. I mean, there was the Chicago 8 and Huey Newton. There were some celebrated cases that were political and got the newsprint. Jihad was a newsprint. Bank robbers. You know, even though I might honestly say that the bulk of that money went for land, identification, building the underground. You know, we're trying to secure the five states down the Black Belt South to build a nation, the Republic of New Africa, that's Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, South Carolina. We're really talking about nation building, and so that spirit, when you get captured, goes with you. You carry that spirit of fight with you. And I carry that spirit of fight with me to this day. So So even though there'd be hard days, they weren't hard in the sense that it just wasn't quite like that. You just realized there's something about knowing who you are and knowing the enemy. Sometimes the problem comes today because we don't know who we are and we don't know the enemy. I mean, you know what, when the lines of demarcation are clearly drawn in the sand, things change. You can adjust your mind accordingly. And when you don't know that, you're confused, saddened, despondent. What's going on? What are you going to do now, Mr. Ricochet? And you may not be able to put it together. So I was fortunate, but it's a combination of those things for the beautiful person to ask that question.
Again, Eric McDavid.
I have a question for you.
Hold on, real quick. You brought up a real big point right there that I wanted to, like, please, if I could.
No problem.
That point of knowing yourself.
Yeah.
And knowing what, where you are compared to where that line is in the sand. You don't know who you are. You ain't gonna know where you are. You can be all discombobulated.
Indeed.
So you can't pay attention to what's going on. But a freight train could be driving right by you and you ain't going to notice because you don't know who you are. And so that was one of the huge things that I dealt with when I was in isolation for those 28 months was I was already at a point. I lucked out, bro, for real. I was already at a point to where I knew myself and I was comfortable with who I was. And I had an understanding of who I was. And I didn't have to go through the learning experience of being in isolation and learning myself at the same time.
Right. That's a wonderful thing. Right? Yeah.
And so if you know who you are, mm-hmm. Right, you can wiggle your toes and feel your toes and know all the way from down there up to the top if you still got some stuff up top.
And just as a little footnote to that, you know, when you visit a political prisoner, you come out of it so enriched. I know as a lawyer, when I would visit some of my clients, I would look forward to the day. I would take all day Saturday to go to Trenton to see Richard Williams. I would go in to see Sekou Odinga and Bilal Sunni Ali on a Sunday morning. I even brought ice cream to them once, smuggled it in. Me, Iceland. Anyway, it is such a wonderful, uplifting experience because they are men and women who have found themselves in the movement, in doing something for others, and they still carry that spirit within them. You're not going to get any hangdog. You're not going to get any, oh my God, I'm in this terrible position. It's all very upbeat, all what can we do? What are you doing? How can I help you do the things you do? Just really remarkable. Treat yourself. Write somebody a letter and then go visit them. I'm telling you, you will never regret it. Changes things.
Getting letters is great, and I understand that. And it was it kept me alive and knowing that I had things to do and things to say because people ask me what to say. They asked me to write politically, not just as a friend, but politically too. And I wasn't forgotten. But what really, I had something exceptional. I had a son, 12 years old. When I went in, he was out there. They brought my son across the United States. They brought him down to Atlanta, over to Leavenworth, to visit me. And then later, my son grew up. He brought his two kids to come and see me. And that's like a bundle of letters. Mm. Having family support is great. We all don't have family support when we're inside. And that is important is having a public support. We're not trying to politicize you. I'm not trying to make you a panther. I'm not trying to make you a socialist or a communist or an anarchist if you're not. I'm just trying to tell you who I am and what I believe, and I'm not going to say I'm sorry for what I did when they locked me up. Apologizing, it's not a sign of weakness, if you want to go ahead and do it. But I when I was a social prisoner, I was a bank, I was a robber. I did it because I was trying to make money for my family. I couldn't get a job. When I first got out, I couldn't get a job, a decent job. So I went into robbery. The second time, my wife is First Nation. She believes in a potlatch. When we have money, she just gives it away. I mean, that's potlatch. And I really didn't understand. It took me a long time to understand potlatch. And there's still First Nation people up around Seattle who still do the same thing. As soon as they get money, they just give it away to the people who need it. Because that's what they said. If you have something, you have to give it away. But then I became a political prisoner inside. Now, I was a social prisoner when I came into prison. But I became political. I started as a Panther. I started with those illegal immigrants from Canada. And I noticed that George Jackson, the man that really inspired me, more than anybody in prison, of all prisoners I ever knew, and I've read a lot about him. I've read about Malcolm X and everybody else. But that man really inspired me, and he was a social prisoner when he came in. I don't think it was $25, something like that, he was in prison for. Yeah. But he turned into not only a political prisoner, but a terrific leader. He broke it down so we could all understand what was going on, not only in prison, but in our neighborhoods, in our lives, and what we had to do. He wasn't 100% correct in everything he said, but he was the 99%, if it was there. It really inspired me and made me what I am. And when they named the group the George Jackson Brigade, these were a mixed group of whites, LGBT. We didn't have that word when we went into prison. You have to know what it was. Okay. But we had them in a brigade. And giving that name, I didn't know who they were. And the Panthers in Oakland told me, if you can, go into that group and find out who they are. And as a Panther, I was invited into it. First, I gave them money, and then they said, come on, see what we're doing. And next thing I do, I just hooked up with them, giving them help, giving them direction. But what I'm trying to say is support comes from telephone calls, from letters, from visits. And we try and do the same now that we're out. I do telephone calls into prisons when I can. Letters and visits. This Rock newsletter, I get a chance, because I'm one of the editors, to stick in my little bit every once in a while. But these newsletters are all written by convicts, prisoners inside of California. And they inspire me too, just listening to them. I try hard trying to get consciousness of people outside me. What they've done, they pay for it. They send me money in order to print this thing. They send me stamps in order to send the printed thing back into them. They send me money to buy printing cartridges to do this and a paper to do this. These are prisoners. And it all takes us to need about 2 candy bars a month to keep this thing going. We were sending 600 at a time in, and they were distributed among all the prisoners. It ended up shutting down 160,000 prisoners for 10 days. Okay. What I'm trying to say is these are letters going back and forth. Letters we're writing to them, and letters they're sending to us. We're supporting each other. Most of those people are social prisoners, but they're getting politicized. They're politicizing themselves. They have terrific people in there who don't have anything to do in solitary confinement for 20, 30, and 40 years in solitary confinement, but read politics and understand what's going on and pass it on to the people around them. So you guys who are sending those stamps and letters in, you're really important to me. You're important to me, and you're important to those guys. I know sometimes you don't like to reach them. You say, well, man, maybe they're a white supremacist, and they're not exactly... The white supremacists were the ones that helped lead that strike against solitary confinement and isolation in the California system. And they've changed things, not only there, but in a lot of other states have looked at what was going on there, the information that's been coming out, and they're starting to close down them solitary confinements. So you guys are really, really important. Thank you.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a couple of questions if time permits, you know, but like we're up here talking about some of our exploits so you can get to know us and share with you, and we really appreciate you, but much of our time is spent doing just what we're doing now, and maybe more formal settings, conferences, traveling. I am the chairperson for the National Jericho Movement, which is... you can look it up on the internet easy, the Jericho Movement. Just Google search engine that. And you will see the listing of many of the political prisoners that we represent, from the the liberation struggles and movements from the 60s and 70s, and some moving up further. Sister Lynn was on our list when she was incarcerated, and Eric was also. You know, we spend all this time doing it, so I just want to, and you hear, you're kind of hearing what we're saying, it's kind of coming off on the fly because it's informal, you got that. But I'd like to hear maybe some, now that you see where we're coming from about the importance of passing the torch and explaining to you about freedom fighters and the need to be supported, I just wanted to ask some ideas and suggestions you may have listening at this, how that type of message might be spread out more so more people can grasp that and understand and make that historical connection. From your vantage point, this hearing, how might that be broadcast where people can genuinely know more about the struggles and what the sacrifice so we can maybe advance the struggles of the day?
I want to respond to that. I also think that my question that I had early sort of parlays into that. In that, I think that you're doing a great job. I think that the message is really building me and building my identity as an activist, so I feel great being here, and I think you're being effective and powerful. So my question in organizing in a women's prison is a little bit about the message, is maybe some of the gendering of it, and how to speak with women about organizing in a prison, and maybe some more specific experiences of organizing in the prison, if there are. I understand there's some wisdom at the table about that topic. And also, my understanding, and it's obvious that women are very much on the forefront of a lot of social movements, but maybe for some of the more social prisoners, how they become politicized and how we can overcome some of the gender stereotypes that are apparent everywhere, but very much so in a prison. And overcome, sorry this became long, let me get to the point here, overcome the layer of gender oppression that is domestic violence experience and male guards and the different ways that they suppress it by taking away very important things that are commodities but are identities, a building for women like makeup, and also family visits, and getting back to be a mom and the fear of the sentence. So just that whole weight as a female prisoner, how to communicate and support them in a different way and replace some of the gender violence that the prison puts them in, which is a very male, you know, the men's clothes, the men's soap, everything's built for a man in a prison. So that's what I want to speak
about. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, let me start out by saying with the worst. The New York Times had an editorial yesterday about the fact that women are still shackled when they're giving birth in prison. So if you, yes, think about that. Shackled to the bed as they give birth, and this was in the Times saying it should be stopped immediately. This is in New York, and I think it's also true, as far as I knew, in the federal system as well. So if you start with the worst of the worst and you go from there, you organize by trying, just as you do on the outside, to make people relate their problems to political solutions, to let them see that there are political answers to the questions that they're asking. It isn't personal, it is political. And you do that. It is not organizing in prison, and I'm sure my comrades here will agree with me, is not what it was in the 70s and 80s. It is really the minute a flyer goes out, they move everybody. They get rid of you. And they got plenty of new prisons to do it in, as Jerry Codd is telling me. So you really have to work very, very carefully, and you just have to seize every moment to politicize people, to talk to them about the situation. I had a friend, and she came to me and she said, you know, I was very close to so-and-so. She was a black woman. This other woman was a white woman. And she said, and the other day she started talking about the and nigga this and nigga that. She says, and I was so hurt by it. I couldn't believe it. Well, I said, people have underlying feelings that they don't reveal until they feel they know you very well, and then they think they can get away with it. But what was more interesting to me was I said, but what did you do? What did you say back to her? And she didn't answer me. So I actually got her a poem. I love poetry. And this poem was by our friend Mongo, who is a political prisoner in Omaha, Nebraska, doing very heavy time for something he didn't do, he and his co-defendant Ed Poindexter. And it's a wonderful poem about the use of the word nigga and what it means today and how so many young people use it indiscriminately. And I gave her that, and she made copies of that, and she distributed them. So you never know where a certain influence will end, and you just have to pick up people where they are and work with them and hope that at the end it will come out in a political way and they will be changed forever. I think I can't tell you that I organized a lot of people, but I think that when you're in jail, by example, you organize a lot of people. And of course, people used to say, but why are you here? You shouldn't be here. And then I'd say, I am here. I'm here the same way you're here. I did what they didn't like, but I understand why they didn't like it and why they put me here. And I ask you to understand the same thing about your situation. So there's a lot of ways to do it. You can't work out every single thing that's going to come up. And it's not going to be a mass thing, usually. Although Pelican Bay was certainly a mass thing, and that was all over the California prison system. But that is highly unusual. And of course, we always, and at this time of the year, we think about it, Attica, where there just wasn't enough teeth there to withstand. It was too isolated, too alone. There wasn't enough to carry the day. So it's a tricky business organizing in prison. But I think you can go a long way by making visits, by talking to people, by getting them to talk to you about their problems, and then giving them political answers to those problems, because you come from a different place than they're used to. And especially in the women, you know, so many women are there because they had a boyfriend that asked them to do this, or an old man that said, just take this package across town, it's got nothing in it. And they get picked up, and they're in jail forever. So it is tricky, but it can be done.
I think one of the things that, as a suggestion, you know, because like Lynn said, it's a complicated world. I mean, we're talking about over 300 million people. It's not like another country that may have one or two ethnic groups. It's organizing in a capitalist society. Your neighbor just lost their house. You have yours. One person's unemployed and homeless. I'm not. And they have it such a way in the United States that it is so stratified and mixed up, you know, like that. You know, there's a rich person driving down the way with his Bentley, and then you are, you know, helping, you know, grubbing the ground. And they said that, yeah, I was, one of my workout partners at one time was Miguel Ayad on the first World Trade Center bombing. And I remember, you know, we used to run the track together, and I would just remember something he said stuck in my mind. He said, it's just not bad enough for everybody. It's bad enough for you. You're going through a little bit of stuff, ain't you, bro? But not me, necessarily. And so, you know, and as capitalism would drive us, I'm trying to hang on to mine and maybe get something else, too. You know, like lottery dreams and aspirations. And it's just, you know, so what I suggest is that individually, as we hear messages that are new and awakening for us in our mind, that we can kind of like run that through our own cycle and share it with our significant others, you know, our spouses, our children. So it becomes the old principle of each one teach one. Slowly building like that. You know, when somebody makes a bigoted statement that maybe you directly or indirectly, I mean, you can confront it at work. Well, I don't appreciate that comment about the women that you just made. That's not a funny joke. Or if you can't say that directly because of the circumstances, at least, you know, you want a num-num, you have to sit there and smell it. So, but each one teaching one. Organizationally, you know, the Anarchist Black Cross, that's hosting us here, Jericho, all of us, we're going to continue to listen to you, to try to make more collaborations and do better what we do, because we want to be main. When you use the word vanguard in the United States today, what you're really talking about is organizations and collectives and groups of people that are able to be consistent. We were there last year, 10 years ago, we'll be there tomorrow. We're doing this, we're serving the people's needs, we're addressing them. Because at some point in time, as history would have it, the rise and falls of nations, that the garbage is going to hit the fan. And we just want to make sure that we are there to provide the leadership and the resources, you know, to direct the energy of the people as it emerges and explodes on the street. And I recommend everybody read the book, well, not so much the book, but the movie, Sam Greenlee, who passed away not too long ago. He wrote a book, and there's a subsequent movie, The Spook Who Sat by the Door, so those who did not hear of it and have plans to write that. And Amazon that joint. And about staying relevant, you know, and you can't force situations to happen. You don't want to create a chaos out of a chaotic situation. You don't want to make it hard on people and romanticize the struggle, because that stuff ain't fine. You got to redo your workout plan. You got to constantly refresh yourself and reevaluate. I work for a nonprofit. So guys, they say I'm bringing nonprofit stuff to the table.
You said that one time in a conference call.
Constantly reevaluation. Every year you reevaluate it. Did you produce what you say you were going to produce? And this is not nonprofit, but there's something to be gleaned from that. You say you're going to do it, did you? Did you? You talk that yin yang, but did you do it? Are you complaining? Are you BSing? Can you account for something? Can you? And what are your measurements? This is a quantifiable nonprofit. But we can extrapolate those things that we can and apply it to our struggle for liberation and self-determination. Did we do it? Can we evaluate it in some type of way? Is it working? You know, so that's what I would suggest for everybody in here. You know, we learned something and some information. You could have might have been up here and said, just like us, even without the prison experience. So we value that. We're not tripping on the fact that we're coming with the 411 and you're listening. But that's why I said we humble ourselves in front of you, but we're proud to bring our experiences before you. But each one teach one. And you be ready when that shit hits the fan.
I didn't know we were going to do that quick. But I'd like to say one thing about to add on to what Jai was saying. And then it's just about, since I've been out, I've worked on a lot of different issues, you know, from anti-death penalty to isolation in the control units and whatnot. But, people know about liberalism and what Lau wrote about combat liberalism. I really think that we need to revisit it in all our work. It really helped me a lot when we were under. And I think that, I mean, it calls for a lot of unity. People have to have a lot of unity to put it into practice. But I think it will help us all. And the other thing is, I just wanted to end with a comrade I just learned about, Liz Fink, passed. And she, you know, contributed a lot, man, in the struggle. She worked on our case, she worked on Attica case, it got a lot of people out of jail, and it just would be remiss for me not to say anything here about Liz. You know, she worked on our camp, on our trial with Lynn. I met them both when I was doing our trial, and it was really, I mean, really enriching experience. Man.
People who have been lost and really made some massive contributions. Hugo, you know, here and now, part of the same. And I just want to, like, take a minute to remember him. Rest in power, Hugo.
Asheville FM on WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville. This is Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness.
And I'm William Goodenough.
Have a great week.